listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you tomorrow. For our listeners in the Pacific Northwest, and particularly in the Portland area, Salem, Oregon as well, the capital of Oregon, tomorrow night, Friday night, 7 to 9 p.m., at the First Unitarian Church in Portland, I will be giving the Marilyn Sewell Speaking of Justice lecture. It's going to be on the topic of corporate personhood. Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. And that's tomorrow night. And then Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Grand Theater in Salem, same speech, same topic, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And then Saturday afternoon at around 5 o'clock, I will be giving a talk at the Portland Area Global AIDS Coalition, PAGAC.org is their website for more information on that. And hope to also get in a meal with our kids over at Dala's Ethiopian, our favorite restaurant in the world. And but it's going to be an insane and busy weekend. And so Dr. Mike Newcomb is going to be filling in for me tomorrow because I'll be on an airplane all day getting to Portland. And thank you to him for that. And also thank you to Senator Bernie Sanders for accommodating my schedule change and doing Brunch with Bernie with us today, right now. Bernie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Thank you. And thank you for putting up with my long preface there. Sorry. A lot going on in the Senate, a lot going on in your world there. You want to share with us what's going, what's up?
There is. There is a great deal that's going on. Let me begin by saying, and I think you mentioned this in your earlier comments, that as a nation, we are making progress in a number of areas, and we should be very proud of the progress that we're making. Rhode Island now becomes the 10th state to approve gay marriage. Vermont did it a number of years ago. You know, we take it for granted now that we have an African-American president of the United States. 20 or 30 years ago, Tom, you and I would never have believed that that would have happened in our lifetime. We're making progress in that area. We're seeing more and more women being elected to national office in the Senate and the House, state legislatures. And while the assaults against women's right to choose continues and intensifies, and another area in terms of occupational opportunities, political leadership, women are making real progress. So there's a lot of good news out there. I think what we should be mindful of is that while that is happening, there is some bad news, and the bad news centers on the fact that economically, as a nation, we are in many respects moving in exactly the wrong way. And that is that study after study continues to tell us that the middle class is shrinking. People on the top are doing phenomenally well, and unemployment is not really at the official 7.6 percent level, but is much closer to 14% if you count those people who have given up looking for work and are working part-time. The other day, the Pew Research Center came out with a report in terms of distribution of wealth, where they said that between 2009 and 2011, all of the new wealth generated in this country during that period went to the top 7%, while the bottom 93% of Americans saw a net reduction in their wealth. So all of the new wealth went to the people in the top 7%. What we know is between 2009 and 2011, all of the new income went to the top 1%. All the new income generated went to the top 1%. So we are looking at a situation where Wall Street and large corporations are in many ways experiencing record-breaking profits, while tens and tens and tens of millions of families, people listening to this show right now, are trying to figure out how they're going to fill up their gas tank, the amount of money that they need to fill up their gas tank to get to work, how they're going to pay for their kid to go to the dentist, how they can afford to send their kids to college, in some cases, how they're going to pay the rent or the mortgage, or feed their families. So on one hand, as a nation, in terms of social issues, we're making some progress. On the other hand, in terms of economic issues, we are in many ways losing ground, and in my view, moving to an oligarchic form of society where a few people on the top have incredible wealth and incredible power, while the people at the bottom have neither. One of the issues that we are working on right now is the issue of trying to end the sequestration. And we're seeing the problems of sequestration being manifested now in air travel because we have to furlough some of the air control people, meaning delays in flights. But it's not only air traffic. It is kids being thrown off of the Head Start program, people losing very basic benefits, cutbacks in unemployment insurance, and so forth and so on. The solution, in my view, to that issue is to end sequestration, which everybody acknowledges is a terrible way to do deficit reduction, and in fact move toward an agreement on the budget, which must include substantial new revenue coming from large corporations who today, in some cases, do not pay a nickel in taxes. I was on the floor yesterday just talking about some of these companies. Let me give you and the listeners just a few examples of some of the outrages that currently exist within our tax system. Just a few. Mm-hmm. Bank of America. Now, you remember our friends at Bank of America? We bailed them out 5 years ago. In 2010, Bank of America set up more than 200 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands to avoid paying U.S. taxes. What do we think about that? Large, profitable Wall Street firm, 200 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands, don't pay any taxes. And not only in recent years did they not pay any federal income taxes, but they received a rebate from the IRS worth $1.9 billion. J.P. Morgan Chase in 2010, J.P. Morgan Chase operated 83 subsidiaries incorporated in offshore tax havens to avoid paying $4.9 billion in U.S. taxes. Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, General Electric, during the last 5 years, GE made $81 billion in profits. Not only did they avoid paying federal income taxes during these years, they received a tax rebate of $3 billion. How's that? Pretty good deal?
Good work if you can get it.
Good. And these guys, of course, all of these huge multinational corporations, Wall Street firms, have hundreds of well-paid accountants to figure out ways that these guys can avoid paying taxes. And then on the other hand, they have spending billions of dollars collectively in lobbying to make sure that these loopholes exist. Bottom line here is that before we cut Social Security, as some people want to do, cut programs and benefits for disabled vets, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, education, nutrition programs. Before we do those things, I think it makes a little bit more sense to end the absurdity of one out of four corporations pay nothing in taxes and end these loopholes by which these large, very profitable multinationals avoid paying anything and in some cases actually getting rebates from the IRS. So that is one of the issues that we are focusing on right now. As I think many listeners know, the immigration bill is going to come to the floor probably in another week. I am a strong believer that we have got to grant the path toward citizenship for those people in this country now, but I do worry about the guest worker program and flooding this country with low-wage workers at a time when wages are going down for American workers.
We'll be back with your questions for Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting. Brunch with Bernie a day early here on the Tom Hartman program. Yeah, we're live. It's Thursday. It's 16 minutes past 3 o'clock on the Eastern Coast.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
And check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for his newsletter. It's a great news site in and of itself. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say no, as I will be saying tomorrow night in Portland, Oregon, at the Unitarian Church at 7 o'clock. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls a day early. Yes, it's Thursday. We're live, and Bernie is with us. Steve in River Forest, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator, do you think it would be fair to refer to the sequester as the small government experiment? And if so, why are the Republicans away from their endorsement? They should be in heaven right now.
Well, you're right. Many, many Republicans, of course, voted for sequestration. But they don't like the results of sequestration when it hits them in the face. They have the theory that you can cut, and nothing bad happens. And suddenly when we have to lay off a significant number of air controllers and slow down air traffic, oh, wow, how did this happen? What a shock. Or when we 70,000 kids are thrown off of Head Start, not that many Republicans worry about that. Oh, my goodness, what a shock. So I think our Republican friends have told us very clearly that they would prefer massive cuts, including cuts in the military, rather than asking the wealthiest people in this country and large corporations to pay a nickel more in taxes. And that is, and I don't know that everybody knows that, that is the great debate that is taking place right now. In the midst of all of the income and wealth inequality, in the midst of the collapse of the middle class and all of the need that is out there, what our Republican friends are saying, hey, one out of four corporations pays nothing in taxes, at 12% of profits, corporate taxes today, effective taxes, are the lowest that they've been since 1972. Not a problem. We're prepared to cut. We're prepared to have austerity for working families, but we have got to do everything that we can to protect multinational corporations and the wealthy. That is the issue.
Joan in Owosso, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator. I would like to know why President Obama doesn't print money and provide jobs like FDR did. We're in that type of a depression now. And if these corporations don't want to provide this living wage jobs, it's high time our government did.
Joan, I agree with you. I think one of the tragedies of the moment is that all of the focus here in Washington, including primarily the White House, not 100% from the White House, but significantly, is on deficit reduction. Deficit reduction is a real issue. We have got to address it, and I've just suggested a moment ago how we can raise the revenue to address it. But in the midst of all of this, I think what Capitol Hill, what the president, what the Congress is forgetting about is that real unemployment in this country is not 7.6%. It is closer to 14%, including those people who work in part-time when they want to work full-time, people who have given up looking for work. Youth unemployment. You know, Tom, do you know what is happening for young people in this country? People graduating high school, kids graduating college deeply in debt. There's nothing out there for them. Yeah. Unemployment, sky high. What does that mean to a young person as they start to leave home and want to get out in the workforce, want to be independent, want to set their, become adults when they can't go out and find a job? It is a terrible thing for this younger generation. So I think Joan of Michigan is exactly right. We should be creating millions and millions of jobs. And we know how to create those jobs. In Vermont, in Michigan, all over this country, we have an infrastructure which is crumbling, roads, bridges, water systems, schools, rail. We know that we can put people back to work. We have several trillion dollars of unmet needs in our infrastructure. We have to transform our energy system in order to deal with global warming. Wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, that creates jobs. We need more teachers. We need to be creating more teachers, more child care workers, not laying them off. So we know how to create the jobs. Joan is absolutely right. We have a jobs crisis in America, and we have got to address it.
Dennis in St. Ann, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Dennis? No, Dennis. Ed in Klamath Falls, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good day, Senator Sanders.
How are you?
I was wondering if you would be willing to sponsor a bill that only Americans and American corporations can do business in America, and further, that Americans and American corporations must keep their money in American banks to solve that problem of the Mitt Romneys of the world keeping their money overseas.
Well, Ed, I agree with you about the problem. I don't know that in a global economy that's going to be a realistic solution. But I'll tell you what we are working on, and you'd be interested in this, Ed. We have now some examples of billionaires who are giving up their American citizenship because they don't want to pay taxes in this country, and they're moving to countries where they don't have to pay any taxes at all. And we're working on legislation which says to those people who have sold out their own nation, they made their money in America, and now they don't want to pay taxes in America. What we're saying is if you give up your citizenship, and we're working on legislation to do this, guess what? You're not coming back to America. You're not going to go to some other country and then get a visa or get a passport that allows you to come back to the United States. If you want to disown America, you want to leave America to avoid paying taxes, don't come back to this country. I think, Ed, there are a number of ways we have to address the issue of corporations reinvesting in America and not in China. I think your approach is probably not the best way. But the goal has got to be that corporate America, that those folks that want us to buy their products, have got to produce those products here in the United States of America and not in China or Vietnam.
And you've been leading the charge in that in some both large ways and small ways. Like
yes, we're having some modest success in the Smithsonian museums. We are transforming their gift shops where they're now going to see, you're going to see more and more American-made products rather than overseas products. And as chairman of the Veterans Administration, we're working on that within the VA as well.
It's marvelous. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting. We're doing it a day early because I'm going to be flying out to Portland tomorrow to give the Marilyn Sewell Speaking of Justice lecture. So your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders in our national town hall meeting today, Thursday, live here on the program. We'll be back with more of your calls for Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. There's a pile of great information there. A lot of information you won't find a lot of other places. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie, a day early here on Thursday. Senator Sanders is with us, taking your calls at our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie.
And see, Tom, all over America, people think that tomorrow is Saturday and they're off of work, and they're going to be very disappointed to learn they have to be at work tomorrow.
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
But it is Thursday.
It is Thursday, indeed.
Dave, okay, what do we got?
Dave in Hot Springs Village, Arkansas. You are on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for watching on Free Speech TV on DirecTV.
Thank you for being there. Hi, guys. I'm a business school graduate, and it seems to me that this culture of greed that you were talking about earlier, Bernie, is being perpetuated by the money flowing into these business schools, assuring that each generation that comes out of there has the same culture as the old guys who set the curriculum, actually, by pouring money into these schools. And I just wonder what you thought about that. I don't think there's anything you can do about it legislatively, but I know damn well it's happening.
Dave, I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, what people have got to appreciate is the folks who have the money, the folks whose religion, in fact, is greed, they don't just put their money under their mattresses. I mentioned earlier, the Koch brothers is an example of one of the most powerful right-wing families in America. They spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to elect candidates that will support their interests. They're now interested in buying the Chicago Tribune, media empire, which consists of many, many newspapers and television stations in order to influence America. But as Dave indicates, these guys put huge amounts of money into universities and into business schools. They endow chairs to give a right-wing ideology. And what's particularly sad, and I suspect Dave would agree with me, is we've had some great business people in our country and have them today, people who see their function as to produce good products, provide good services, pay their workers a decent wage, make profits. Profits is not a dirty word. But you can do those things, create jobs, without extolling greed, and more for the people on top. But I think Dave's point is very well. These guys endow business schools. They set up all of these think tanks to help espouse their points of view. So I would agree with Dave.
Robert in Joliet, Illinois, listening to WCPT. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
How you doing, Senator Sanders and Tom? Just to add on to the last comment, and they're even buying up publishing companies like McGraw-Hill and Changing History in general. But what I wanted to say is, like, I feel like as a Democrat that we kind of need to either change the party by, you know, getting involved, or just to stand behind like-minded independents like Senator Bernie Sanders, and I wanted to get you guys' comment on that. Do you feel like it's time for that, since recently President Obama has backed up Big Pharma and given them more, I should say, immunity from, like, giving them more control of their patents? And I think that I feel like he's turning, the administration is turning their back on us with doing so, look, giving more immunity to corporations and such.
Well, Robert, thanks for the question. I think it's a very, very important question. And I respond to you as the longest serving independent in the history of the United States Congress, 16 years in the House, and now I'm in my seventh year in the Senate. Look, this is what you got. You have the Republican Party now is a right-wing extremist party dominated by the Tea Party. You have folks in that party who, you know, will go to the wall protecting the wealthiest, the most powerful people in this country while they will destroy Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, etc. You have a Democratic Party which has also moved to the right. I think years ago, certainly under FDR, under Harry Truman, the Democratic Party was considered to be the party of working people. I'm not sure that most people think that it is anymore because, you know, as Tom and I have discussed for a very long time, the big money interests have so much influence, and it's not just over the Republican Party, it's over the Democratic Party as well. So you see Democratic presidents, whether it's Bill Clinton, and I thought Clinton was a decent president, but let's not forget, when we talk about trade policies, it was Clinton who signed NAFTA. It was under Clinton that we deregulated Wall Street, led by his Secretary of Treasury, Robert Rubin. Under Obama, we're continuing these bad trade policies. Under Obama, we have not stood up to Wall Street and moved forward to breaking up these large financial institutions that have so much power. Under Obama, there's a proposal out there that calls for cutting Social Security. So I think, Robert, the big money interests have so much power that they have enormous influence on economic issues over both political parties. And I would hope that people who want the Democratic Party to be a party that represents the average person, that person in the middle class, lower-income people, working people, elderly people, that they have got to demand that the president and members of Congress stand with them. And right now, the issue that I am focusing on is the so-called chain CPI. It is totally absurd that this president of the United States is bringing forth a proposal that would cut benefits for seniors between the age of 65 and 75. That's $650 a year by the time you're 75. That is a lot of money for somebody getting by on $15,000 a year. The president should not be doing that. He should be listening. I'll give you an example of something which was rather remarkable. There was a poll that just came out the other day, Tom, and it came out from the Gallup poll. And this is what it said. This is just last week. A record-breaking 52% of the American people believe that the federal government, and I quote, should redistribute wealth by heavy taxes on the rich, end of quote. Wow. Now, Tom, how many Democrats out there do you think that the government should redistribute wealth by heavy taxes on the rich?
Nobody's saying it out loud.
Nobody even talks about it.
Yeah.
You have a handful of us, and we have some wonderful people in the House Progressive Caucus, people like Keith Ellison, Raul Grijalva, and others, many others there. Mm. We had a few people in the Senate. This is what a majority of the American people believe. And the average Democrat wouldn't even vaguely go near that. So, to get back to the point that Robert made, yes, Robert, I think people have got to get involved in the political process and tell Democrats you're not going to cut Social Security. And if you do, you know what? You may find primary opposition next time around. But we have got to at least have one party or a section of a party standing up for working families.
Phil in Franklinville, New Jersey, listening on Sirius Satellite Radio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders, Phil.
Hey, how you doing, Sanders?
Good.
I have a question. Now, I hear that you said that these people, the big corporation put their money over in the Cayman Islands. And I was trying to wanted to know, is there any kind of way that you can have them bring that money back? Because the reason why I asked that question, I heard today that AT&T got hundreds of billions of dollars over there in those in the Cayman Islands, somewhere over there. But yet, they want to borrow $100 billion to pay their investors, you know what I mean, instead of using their money over there because they're going to get taxed. You know, and I like what you said earlier, that y'all was working on a bill that if somebody takes their money out of what's coming, they give up their citizens. I agree with that 100%, you know what I mean, because I don't think it's fair that they could take their money, put it over there in the Cayman Islands, I didn't want to borrow money. You know what I'm saying? And here,
Phil, here's what we're doing. To answer your question, the answer is absolutely, and I've introduced legislation to do that. Right now, we are losing about $100 billion every single year. That is a huge amount of money. That will, you know, help us in a very significant way, not only deal with the deficit, but to create the jobs that we need by investing in infrastructure. $100 billion every year just by companies who are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and elsewhere. We have introduced legislation to end that. It is totally absurd that they're allowed to do that and not pay any taxes in the United States on very, very substantial profits. So, Phil, the answer to your question is, yes, there is something we can do. I've proposed ideas. Other people have different ideas. It's something we must do.
Tony in Knoxville, Tennessee. Quick question for Bernie. We got a minute to the break. Tony?
Yes, sir.
A quick question, please. We just have a few seconds.
Yes, sir. Senator, it's a pleasure to talk to you. Somebody up there in Washington's got some sense anyway. The question I had was, is there any way that you could get with a couple other senators or congressmen and draft legislation to fix Social Security by the government having to pay back what they took out of it year after year after year with 1.5% interest and then get a vote on that, and then we'd know who was really serious about fixing Social Security?
Okay, Tony, let me answer your I guess, Tom, we going to a break?
Yeah, about half a minute.
All right, let me just start off, and we'll deal with Tony's very good question. Tony, here is the fact. Don't believe everything you see on TV. Social Security today has a $2.6 trillion surplus. Surplus. No one disputes that. Well, we'll return to this issue after the break.
Okay. It is 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, answering your questions. Check out his website over at sanders.senate.gov. Yeah, it's a day early, by the way. You're not hearing a rerun. We are live, and we'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website over at sanders.senate.gov. There's a lot of great information there, and you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz for his newsletter. Welcome back to the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, a day early. Senator Sanders taking your calls at our National Town Hall meeting. Pam in Falls Church, Virginia. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders. Thank you so much for all your work. I wanted to ask whether there is any kind of government agency that has or is currently tracking or keeping record online or elsewhere of American companies and manufacturers that are sending jobs overseas and their operations overseas. And I agree with both of you regarding the influence of the corporate media. So many people we know just don't seem to be aware of current issues like the dangers of fracking, Monsanto Corporation, our foods, and the Keystone Pipeline. And thank you for all your efforts, and visited your lovely state, Lower Vermont, Putney, and Brattleboro recently after a long absence. Thank you so much.
Great, and please come back. Thank you very much, Pam. And you've asked a very good question, and the answer is we do have information about companies that are moving jobs abroad. What we know, and I'm looking at an article that recently it was just recently published, since 1999, Pam, employment by U.S. multinationals is down by 1.1 million inside the United States. They have shrunk their workforce inside the United States since 1999 by 1.1 million, but it is up in that same time period by 3.8 million people overseas. So multinational corporations shrunk their workforce here in the United States. They've significantly expanded abroad. As I think many listeners know, I have been strongly opposed to these trade agreements that have come down the pike for many, many years, from NAFTA to CAFTA to permanent normal trade relations with China, free trade agreements with Korea. And the bottom line of those trade agreements is that American workers are being forced to compete against people around the world earning wages substantially lower than we make in the United States. And the result of that has been the companies, and in the last 10 years, we've lost over 50,000 factories in America, not all of them due to trade, but many of them due to trade. And as we've just heard, companies much prefer to hire people in China and Vietnam at very low wages than an American worker at a decent wage. So that is an enormously significant issue, and we do have some pretty good information on that, Pam.
Truman in Hoopston, Illinois. You're on the air, Senator Sanders.
Yes. Can you hear me?
You're on the air, sir.
Hey, Senator was on there asking questions or answering questions or what have you. And my question is, if the government would quit putting out that money to help the oil companies and get them to reduce the gas prices, people like myself would have more money in my pocket for lower gas prices, and I would spend that money because probably 90% of the people that work live from paycheck to paycheck. Therefore, they're going to spend money and when they got it in their pockets.
Well, Truman, very good point. And I absolutely agree with you. It's an issue we have been involved in. So let me take a minute to talk a little bit about why prices are as high as they are. And by the way, prices are going down. I know in Vermont they're going down fairly significantly. First thought, Truman, you will be shocked to know the theory, and Tom, you and I have discussed this, the theory of why prices go up is that when supply is limited and demand goes up, why then prices naturally go up. That's what you learned in high school. Unfortunately, that theory does not seem to apply to gas and oil prices, because over the last number of years, we have had ample supply, and in the United States, demand has actually gone down for a variety of reasons, and yet price spiked way, way up. There are a number of reasons why gas prices are as high as they are, and we don't know it definitively. For a start, companies like ExxonMobil and the other large oil companies have a very significant control over the market. They are enormously profitable year after year after year. These companies are ripping off consumers, making billions and billions of dollars in profit. That's number one, the oil companies. Number two, this will surprise people, the culprit is not just the oil companies. We got our good friends in Wall Street right now who own most of the oil on the oil futures market, the energy futures market. These companies don't use oil. They're not like trucking companies. They're not like airlines. They're not like fuel dealers. They are strictly in the market to drive profits up, prices up, and make a quick profit. We have hyper-speculation, extensive speculation in the oil futures market, which people disagree as to how much it increases the price of a gallon of gas. Is it 20%, 25%? No one's quite sure, but it sure as heck does drive oil prices up. And thirdly, and I've been dealing with this issue back in the state of Vermont, there are parts of states where there really is not vigorous competition between gas stations. What one gas station does is look at another one and says, oh, you're charging $3.50 for a gallon of gas. Well, that's what I'll charge. We have seen in northern Vermont, for example, where you focus a spotlight on this and these guys start competing, prices can go down to a significant degree. So those are the three areas, by which I think consumers are getting ripped off. The oil companies, excessive profits, Wall Street speculating on the oil futures market, and in some parts of the country, not a whole lot of competition between the distributors and gas stations.
Bernie, just a half a minute till the end of the hour here. Oh, not even that. I'm going to have to thank you. Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us this week and for coming in a day early.
Well, my pleasure, Tom. Keep up the good work.
You too, sir. Thank you. Much appreciated. We'll see you a week from tomorrow. We'll be back. Mike Papatonio, actually, is going to be with us. And a little later on, Ocean Robbins here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, Frank Luntz, I think, has he asked everybody to turn off their recording devices, but one guy didn't, and he spoke an inconvenient truth. Far-right conservatism, these are not his words, they're mine. We'll get to his words in just a moment, but you'll get what I'm talking about. Far-right conservatism has become a cult, and Rush Limbaugh has become its leader, or was its leader, arguably is its leader. By definition, a cult is a group or sect bound together by adoration of the same thing, person, ideal. A cult promises you redemption. Tells you if you do what it says, believe as it believes, you will be protected from the evil people who are out to get you and the rest of society. A cult purges itself of non-believers. It actively tries to vilify all those who are not part of the cult, saying that they're doomed, they're destined to go to hell. So how did Limbaugh become the leader of such a large and influential cult? Well, like with any cult, the power that Limbaugh has over his flock has grown over time. Right-wing radio started out in conflict with mainstream society, outside of mainstream society. What was once a little cult guided by Limbaugh has transformed into a massive cult that today has enveloped much of the conservative movement and certainly is almost personified by the Tea Party cult. So how did this transformation happen? Well, like cult leaders do, Limbaugh offered up a theatrical flair and accompanied that with a marketing genius. He offered his followers redemption. He promised them protection from what he told them they should fear, liberals and feminists. He demanded ideological purity and absolute devotion to his ideology of far-right conservative corporatism is what it really was. And he vilified anybody who didn't see things his way. He then managed to convince his followers that faith in his word was more important than facts. No matter what everyone else said, if Rush said it, it must be true. Only information that supports his positions could be believed in. Everything else just lies. And since his first successes, he's been followed by a succession of other right-wing cult leaders, from Glenn Beck to Mark Levin to Alex Jones, which brings us to today. Rush Limbaugh and the rest of the right-wing talk radio cult have conjured up such a large following that they're helping the Koch brothers and the other Tea Party guys drive the polarization within the Republican Party and within America's political discourse. Ironically, so says Frank Luntz, a top Republican consultant and campaign guru. Earlier this week, Luntz told a group of college students at the University of Pennsylvania that Limbaugh and his fellow right-wing talk radio cult leaders are, Frank Luntz's word, problematic for the Republican Party. Why? Because they're responsible for the stark polarization inside that party. This is a secret recording of Luntz's comments. And, well, you can hear for yourself. He's gonna say, you know, they get great ratings. They're driving the message. This isn't happening on the Democratic side. It's only on the Republican side. And then he talks about how Marco Rubio is getting his butt kicked, and then he gets into Rush Limbaugh and Mark Levin. Here it is. This is Frank Luntz himself.
And they get great ratings. And they drive the message. And it's really problematic. And this is not on the Democratic side, it's only on the Republican side. the Democrats are political hostages. They've got every other source of news on their side. And so that is a lot of what's driving. If you don't believe it, you get into this accident. Who's our video fan here? We talked about it. He's getting destroyed by Marco Lynn, by Rush Limbaugh, and a few others. He's trying to find a legitimate, long-term, effective solution to immigration that isn't the traditional Republican approach, and Tom Brady is killing him. That's what's causing this thing underneath, and too many politicians in Washington are playing to it.
So, you know, basically what Luntz is saying is that the right-wing media and this cult following are not serving the national debate, and they're frankly not helping the Republican Party widen its appeal beyond its declining base of aging boomer cultists. But no matter what Frank Luntz says, Limbaugh and the rest of his right-wing media pals are going to continue to rally their followers. It's very profitable. And some of them actually believe this stuff. And they're going to continue to vilify those who dare think otherwise. They're going to continue to paint President Obama as America's anti-hero, using terms like socialist and Muslim to further scare their cult followers into seeing things their way so that they get to be the hero heroes. Well, we were talking yesterday about Superman and all that stuff. Now, the good news here is that there is still some semblance of a normal non-cult media in America. Unlike right-wing media, this non-cult media and even progressive media doesn't behave like cults. It talks about ideas that are widely accepted, social safety net, clean environment, non-discrimination, solid middle class, stuff like that, and that are not in conflict with the rest of society. It's not based on fear or faith. It's based on facts. And we respect other beliefs and ideas instead of vilifying, instead of hating them, instead of preaching hatred about them or fear. And perhaps most importantly, real media, by and large, does not fear or hate the United States of America, does not fear or hate our government, and certainly does not suggest that we all need to be armed to the teeth and ready to attack employees of our own government who are coming to get you. Sadly, that cult is coming dangerously close to having complete control over the Republican Party and much of the political discourse in our country. Thankfully, people are waking up and recognizing that far-wing media is just that, a cult. It's like Jim Jones. It's like, here, have some Kool-Aid. And it's, you know, in my opinion, and in the opinion of Frank Luntz, it's doing the same thing that Jim Jones's Kool-Aid did. It's, you know, he killed his followers with his Kool-Aid. This is killing the Republican Party. And what's serving it? I mean, you've got people worth hundreds of millions of dollars, like Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity, and I don't know if it's hundreds or just tens of millions of dollars, Glenn Beck and Alex Jones, who certainly would aspire to that. You've got these right-wing cult leaders telling us all the groups that we have to be afraid of and everything we have to worry about, rather than offering genuine solutions. And they're, I mean, completely out of the mainstream of America. You do, I mean, as Bernie just quoted that survey this last week, 52% of Americans, right across the board, 52% of Americans, more than half of Americans, think we should actually be radically increasing taxes on rich people like Limbaugh and Hannity and redistributing that income to poor people in America. More than half of Americans. Now, even I don't generally talk about that kind of thing. Although the fact of the matter is progressive taxation, which we've held as a high value in this country, arguably since the founding of this country, Thomas Jefferson talked about progressive taxation. He called it geometric taxation. Thomas Paine preached about it in his booklet, Agrarian Justice, right after America became a country. You know, these are core American values. But instead, what you find is you find these right-wingers who are basically preaching things that will only assist a few thousand multi-hundred millionaires and billionaires. Why? Because they're the ones who are making sure that these guys keep their cult followings going.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And the net of this is that it's not a good thing for the United States of America. You know, having a meritocracy is fine. Having an oligarchy, not so good. It's your media support group for We the People of the United States of America, the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, the Federal Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, is saying we're going to change our rules so that publicly owned corporations, in other words, corporations that issue stock, big companies, if they are giving money to politicians, they have to disclose that to their stockholders, to their owners. Now, doesn't this kind of make common sense? This is called Rule 4-637 of the SEC. Guess what? As the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, is getting ready to say, you know, if you're going to give political, if you're going to take money from your shareholders, money that you would otherwise distribute to them as dividends, from your owners, and give that money to, oh, say, you know, Rand Paul or, you know, fill in the blank, you know, your favorite senator, member of the House of Representatives, whatever, or you're going to do some lobbying with it or whatever. If you're going to do that, you have to tell your owners. Who would possibly be opposed to this? Who could possibly say, hey, there's something wrong with corporations being transparent? I mean, after all, when Citizens United, in the Citizens United decree from, you know, here in our constitutional monarchy, the, you know, from our constitutional monarchs, the five of the nine justices in the Supreme Court, what, there were several pieces to that decision, and one of them that I think was 8-1, as I recall, talked about the importance of transparency, that the solution to the problem of corporations being people and money being speech was that if corporate contributions were simply transparent, if everybody knew what was being given and by whom, it would take the sting out. It would, you know, it would reduce the danger to democracy or to our republic. So that's the official position of the Supreme Court. And the Democrats are saying, fine, you know, corporations are going to give money. If unions are going to give money, let it be disclosed. But the Republicans don't want it to happen. Oh, no, 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 no. They are literally talking in the House of Representatives right now. Eric Cantor, John Boehner, these guys who are living the good life. Kevin McCarthy, these guys who are living the good life on dollars provided to them and junkets and trips and vacations and all kinds of insane things, not to mention campaign contributions and advertising support during their times of elections that are being provided to them by large publicly owned, publicly traded corporations in secret. You know, laundered through groups like Karl Rove's group. So nobody knows where that money actually came from. These Republicans are planning on passing a law out of the House of Representatives to make it illegal, because the SEC wants to start doing this at the end of the month, the end of next month, to make it illegal for the SEC to even say to a corporation, you have to tell your owners how you're spending their money. You get how wild this is? I find it incredible. Rhode Island is now apparently going to be the 10th state to legalize gay marriage. A fine thing, step by step. I'm telling you, within a couple of years, I frankly, I think within 5 years, we are going to see every state in the union, offer gay marriage, and we're going to see the decriminalization of pot. Although that second thing is, I mean, you know, gay marriage, nobody loses money as a consequence of gay marriage. In fact, there are people who will make money as a consequence of gay marriage, the marriage industry. You know, the flower sellers and the wedding chapels and the photographers. And, you know, it's a small industry, but it's an industry. On the other hand, you've got the private prison industry, the tobacco industry, and the alcohol industry joined at the hip in an unholy alliance, along with some of the law enforcement unions and groups who are saying, keep pot illegal. Because it's a multi-billion dollar industry. And I'm not talking about for the people who are selling pot or using pot, but for the people who are running around trying to put people in jail for selling or using pot. So it's going to be more of a challenge, but I think that public opinion is swinging really fast. I mean, look what happened in Colorado and Washington State. So we'll see. But good on Rhode Island. Lincoln Chafee, the governor, says he's looking forward to signing this bill. This is a good thing. CISPA. This is, you know, the, okay, we can spy on you, Bill. The president has threatened to veto it, saying no, the National Security Agency cannot listen into your phone calls and cannot, you know, monitor your internet use and read your emails and all that kind of stuff without at least having a warrant, you know, or some probable cause that they think that you're committing a crime. And that, you know, we all saluted President Obama when he said he was going to veto this thing if it passed. Now, CNET News, the computer magazine, you know, computer aficionado magazine and website, CNET News is reporting now that the NSA and the Department of Defense have been given by the Obama Justice Department a bunch of letters. They call them 2511 letters. In particular to AT&T, we know about, that says, yeah, go ahead, you can spy. Or you can help us spy and not be prosecuted, even though it's illegal. So, you know, which calls into mind, you know, into question, you know, how much of this is just theater? Meanwhile, in Spain, unemployment rates. This is now that this what is this called? It's Rygoff. What's the letter? The Reinhardt-Rogoff paper that said that when a country's debt to GDP ratio goes over 90%, this has been discredited. Spain now has 27% unemployment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So the discredited austerity policies that are being inflicted on Europe and Republicans want to inflict in the United States have been completely discredited. And look at all these people being hurt.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Ah, pigeon alerts. Indeed, actually, it's kind of a twofer today. Pigeons over in Peterborough, UK, Peterborough, England. Members of the Peterborough City Council's Licensing Committee. This is from the Peterborough Telegraph, an article by Ken McCurlin. Were startled as a pair of pigeons flew into the town hall council chamber via an open window on Monday. What, you're startled? You know, the city council is going to start talking about something important. The pigeons are there to listen. I mean, come on, you know, they're robots. You've never seen a dead pigeon. You've never seen a baby pigeon. I mean, they're not there for the food. Actually, they're right down the street, a pastry store in Bridge Street and nearby Greg's Bakers put up a sign warning people not to feed the birds. So what do the birds do? They go show up at the city council meeting. Wait a minute. They can read the sign? Really? Okay. Meanwhile, Jim Javinsky was pointing out to me earlier, millions and millions of birds are standing by in breathless anticipation, waiting for the unveiling of the George W. Bush statue. No, seriously, I don't know if there's a statue or not, but George W. Bush is going to... This has got his library, right? His wife had to explain to him what that was. And And because it's not his library actually isn't a library. There aren't books in it. Instead, there are the promotional items, shall we say. There are little, you know, explanations, you know, rewritings of history, television clips. It's basically, you know, it's like an amusement park, you know, for adults who think that George W. Bush was wonderful. And they're unveiling it apparently on the anniversary of is today the anniversary of May 1st is when it officially opens. Okay, and that's the anniversary of Mission Accomplished, isn't it? When I think it is. I could be wrong, but in any case, they're opening this thing, and Obama is there now along with all the other living presidents to say, you know, okay, here's his library. This is sort of like, you know, the president's club, you know. And he's getting criticized for it. Obama's getting criticized for it. I'm not going to criticize Obama for showing up for this. I mean, I think, you know, it's you can disrespect the man and respect the office. And I have no respect whatsoever for George W. Bush. I think the man is a war criminal and a mass murderer and a sociopath. I'll just say it right out loud. I've said it in many venues many times before. I think when he paints himself in water, as he constantly is doing, at some deep unconscious level, he's trying to wash the blood off his hands that he knows is there, the blood of hundreds of thousands of people who have died because of his lies. That said, I respect the office of the presidency. I think the day that we begin not respecting the institutions of our government that we created, which is us, is the day that we basically become Ronald Reagan Republicans. It's the day that we become anti-American. It's the day that we begin to spit on the graves of the founders of this country. And I'm not willing to go there. So, you know, the office of the presidency, there's this George W. Bush library about his presidency. President Obama wants to show up and you know, shake his hand and say, you know, okay, fine. I mean, if I was president, I probably wouldn't. In fact, if I was president, I would be opening investigations into war crimes by George W. Bush. But that said, I understand, you know, he's president. Anyhow, I was mentioning before the break, Spain breaking records, 27.2% unemployment in the first quarter of this year. That's 6 million Spanish citizens out of work. Why? Because of austerity. Why the austerity? Because of this bizarre study that was done. It was published a couple of years ago, this Reinhart Rogoff study, that now some, you know, 28 or 29-year-old guy who just got his PhD in economics, teaching at some college someplace, looked at the study. And the study, by the way, said that when a country's debt-to-GDP ratio exceeds 90%, which is about where we are, all of a sudden the country just kind of goes into economic stagnation. Turns out that Reinhart Rogoff did their math wrong. Reinhart Rogoff, you know, they didn't tally an entire column of numbers. Reinhart Rogoff completely ignored entire countries that have higher debt-to-GDP ratios than 90% that are doing just fine, thank you very much. They ignored times in the United States when our debt-to-GDP ratio was higher than that, and we were doing very fine, thank you very much. And they ignored the fact that in many cases, when countries get their debt way down, then they go into recession. This is the, I mean, we've had these new money theory folks on the program a number of times, Stephanie Keller and some others, who have suggested that, you know, the public debt, our national debt, is private savings. You want it there. You want people to have something that they can invest in that they know is safe. And whatever its ratio is to GDP is really, by and large, irrelevant. as long as people, you know, will maintain their faith and trust in the country. I mean, Japan's debt to GDP ratio is in the neighborhood of 200%. They're doing okay. People say, oh, what about the lost generation in Japan? I'm sorry, there is no lost generation in Japan. Talk to Eamon Fingledon. He lived there for years and years. He's back in Ireland now, the Irish economist. He wrote a book called In the Jaws of the Dragon. Wrote a number of excellent pieces for Forbes about how the whole Japanese, oh, we're in a crisis. It's just made up. Everybody has health care. Everybody has unemployment insurance. There's no, you know, it's not like it's a third world country like the United States. Japan is doing fine, thank you very much. They have used a slight decrease in their GDP growth rates, which is a consequence of worldwide growth rate. The fact that worldwide there's this crash going on, in large part driven by 32 years of Reaganomics and Thatcheronomics. That has hurt their economy because it's an export-based economy. And so they're using that as an excuse to actually protect their economy, to functionally have tariffs. They don't call them that, but, you know, their VAT tax, their regulations. So, anyhow, I've covered a lot of territory here. Let's get some of your thoughts into this. Paul, listening in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, do you know, by the way, who coined the phrase the lost generation was... Gertrude Stein, the writer,
really
said that about the World War I generation, that they were the lost generation.
Yeah. Huh.
Yep.
Do you know why?
She said it's an anecdote. It has something to do with having her car fixed, but it's just said that they couldn't seem to focus on anything. So it's an anecdote that probably we don't have time for, but that's the first.
Interesting. Well, thanks for that. That bit of trivia.
You were talking about the cultism of the right wing.
Yeah, this belief in things that you cannot see and you cannot prove.
Right.
And slavish, obeisance to it. And I'm probably mangling both those words, but yeah.
Okay, and then you were talking about how Rush Limbaugh. And it got to the point where he said, believe in my word, not in the facts. I mean, that's what he got his followers to do.
Yeah.
And this
global warming, case in point, by the way.
Sure. This is where my thoughts came from. You'll notice that most people on the far right have a heightened degree of religiosity. And this, of course, cultism is typically religious. But this all comes from fetishism. And yes, and I'm going to tell you where.
Not as in Dick Morris likes to lick the toes of prostitutes, that kind of fetish.
I knew you were going to go there, so or somewhere there. Sexual fetishes are the most commonly referred to, but a fetish, actually by definition, is a ritualistic set of thoughts and or behaviors that are necessary for one to obtain some type of emotional gratification.
Right.
This comes from William James. Chapter 1 of his book, 1900, The Varieties of Religious Experiences, where he talks about how religiosity has a certain fetishistic...
Yeah, yeah. I read that book like 35 years ago or so. I mean,
it's a great book. Anybody who wants to know anything about religion has to start with some of that.
And there's a place in there where he talks about, you know, this very thin veil between us and the other worlds that certain things allow us to touch and change.
But the other part was that... is that a lot of it, part of the emotional gratification is anger.
Hmm.
And I did a research on that when I was a graduate student at Michigan State, and one of the things about anger is that people enjoy getting angry.
Yeah, yeah. And so the right just drives this and gives people an emotional release. Very interesting. Paul, thanks for the heads up on that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
46 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back with your calls and my thoughts. The spreadsheet goof behind the global layoffs and more right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, Louise and I had dinner with Ellen Ratner, and she was wearing, well, Louise was wearing too, actually, as she usually does, a little crystal heart made by women who have seen someone die in front of them, mostly in South Sudan, virtually all of them in Africa, in places where Ellen Ratner has actually put these groups together, these people, and
it's
this
a great
is,
Mother's Day gift, Tom.
It is. Well, that's where I was going with this. And this is something that Ellen, you put together this charity, goatsfortheoldgoat.com, and if you're not up for buying goats for slaves, you can support these small women's kind of PTSD support groups, I guess you'd call them, by going to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and checking out these pendants. Louise just yelled, they're beautiful. We bought, 20 of them. And we've given them out. Louise and I have given them out as gifts to a number of people. They're just lovely. Anyhow, Ellen, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. What's going on in the world today?
Okay, well, there's a lot going on. Syria is, the biggest issue, and whether they use sarin gas. As you know, France and Britain yesterday said, hey, we have evidence that they use sarin gas. The White House wasn't so sure. And today, Chuck Hagel, the defense secretary, in Abu Dhabi said, yes, sarin gas was used. The way they were able to do this is by looking at blood tests from Syrian people and detecting the sarin gas there. Now, sarin gas was used by Saddam Hussein. It was also used in that, I think it was Japan had it in the subway.
Mm-hmm.
Very
by
deadly
the cult
gas.
Yeah, the cult
however, the White House is saying that it was used on a small scale.
And you think they're
Chuck
saying
Hagel
this to,
said
to,
this.
To
the
avoid?
The secretary said this was to some degree of varying confidence. Well, I think if you find it in people's blood tests, that's a little more than varying confidence. Now, it's interesting. John McCain, Senator McCain, was on Fox News today. He said the White House is looking for excuses not to intervene in Syria. White House has
See, I agree with
there
McCain
are additional
on that.
Options and contingency plans. But let me ask you a question, because mm-hmm. everybody's asking me. So I said I'd ask you. What would you do?
Has this White House said that if poison gas is used, that will be the point at which they'll intervene?
They said that, yes.
That's the bright red line in the sand?
That was a line in the sand, but now they're not what that line
See,
in
this
the sand
is. This is the this is the problem of making absolute proclamations. I really don't think the United States should be involved in a civil war in Syria, particularly one that has so many different factions and is so messy. And you know, we've seen the kind of damage we've done in some of these other places. On the other hand, you know, any government that is gassing its own people, I mean, you know, we should have been bombing the railway lines to the death camps during World War II. This is nothing close to that in terms of scale, but you get my point. I mean, there is a point at which you say, we can save lives, we're going to do that. I would find this one of the most difficult decisions to make, because there are so many variables and this could go wrong in so many ways. And I think the Obama administration is wise I agree with John McCain that they're trying to avoid, you know, going to war over this. And I think that they're wise in doing so. That's my personal opinion.
Right. I'm speechless myself. Now, before I go to other news, in that same part of the
Have
world.
Have I horrified you, Ellen?
It looks like Israel claims that they have shot down a drone. Hezbollah denied that it is them. It was a reconnaissance drone. Now, I got to tell you something. As you know, you can go to various websites and buy a small little drone. It may not be a big reconnaissance drone, but you could put a simple
You can put
camera
a camera on a model airplane.
Fly those planes and put little cameras on them and
yep.
survey their neighborhood and whatever.
Yep.
So it's very possible. Who knows where it's from?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, is this worth going to war over?
Of course not. But yeah. we're not the ones that shot it down.
Yeah. yeah.
That was done by the Israelis. All
yeah.
right.
Ellen,
you have many.
Ellen, I'm, if I may interrupt, I'm curious
Bush
your
Library,
thoughts.
Bush 41 looks quite frail, but was smiling. President Obama talked about the president starting and kick-starting immigration reform. And we know that Bush 43 was very active in that. In fact, I think I told you before, I asked Tony Snow before he died, I said, Tony, why are you still here at the White House? He said, because, and he was obviously very ill, he said, because I believe in the president's immigration plan. So, and you know, many Republicans voted against Bush's immigration plan.
Right.
Okay, speaking of immigration, Bob Goodlatte is a Republican. He said the House is going to be doing this immigration on piecemeal legislation. The Senate is doing it in one package. So that is going to be happening. It's going to be going through various committees on the House side. Senator Reid said no Obamacare, no getting out of Obamacare for congressional members and staff. They will have it like everybody else. So whether this was a rumor, whether this backdoor negotiation is something that got given to Politico, who was the first one to quote-unquote break the story, or whether they just decide it was a bad issue, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This is also very interesting on the supposed bombing or the supposed bombing of New York City. There was a bombing in Boston. Mayor Bloomberg said he had heard from the FBI that these guys were planning on coming to New York and doing another bomb in New York. Then again, there's some varying questions as to whether there was they were going to party. Unclear about that. Last but not least for you today, Senator Sherrod Brown from the great state of Ohio did an interview with Huffington Post today. He said it was wrong to say that the Dodd-Frank law stopped this big, too big to fail problem. He said that the Treasury Department, the Security and Exchange Commission are too close to Wall Street. Now, you know what happens at these big banks? They have permanent people there from the Treasury Department monitoring things. You know when people work close together, whether you work for a different company or in the same...
Yep, I got it.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And as I noted, I'll be asking that question tomorrow night in Portland. If you're listening in the area, get thee down to the First Unitarian Church, south of West 12th and Main, 7 o'clock. And we're going to have a great old time. And Saturday, 1 to 3 at the Grand Theater in Salem, Oregon. And that should be fun. And then also the Portland Area Global AIDS Coalition. I will be speaking there around 5 o'clock, so as quickly as we can drive from Salem back to Portland, for their Zimbabwe Artists Project annual spring celebration. So a lot of, you know, good stuff going on there. And the website for that is pagac.org. Whether you can show up or not, it's a great organization and well worth visiting their website, PAGAC. So that's where I'll be tomorrow and Saturday, and what we're going to be doing about it. Mike Papantonio is on the line with us. Pap, welcome back.
Tom, how are you?
I am great. Great to have you with us, attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com. And, you know, it seems to me that we have been, and I'd like to get your take on this. You're an attorney, and you really know the Constitution well. This whole thing, you know, the Supreme Court carved a hole in the Fifth Amendment in the Miranda ruling, saying that, you know, if there was basically a ticking time bomb, or in the case of the case that came before the court was a gun, you know, a loaded gun, that the police could ask a few questions before they informed a citizen of his rights. Apparently, you know, it's being reported that this young 19-year-old terrorist, alleged terrorist, stopped talking 16 hours after he began being interrogated because he was read his rights. Mm-hmm. And 16 hours is a whole lot less time than, you know, frankly, I don't think Bush ever would have read him his rights. He'd be in Guantanamo or something. I, you know, this is better than nothing. But still, it may be that frankly they just decided to read him his rights because he had said everything that they thought was useful and there was nothing more left in him. That's my personal theory. Yeah. But shouldn't we, if we are going to say that we are governed by the Constitution and these are the values that we hold to, shouldn't we simply say these are the values we hold to, regardless of the crime?
No, there are exceptions to everything, Tom. I mean, of course, I come at this from having been a prosecutor, but I've also been on the criminal defense side. There are certain situations. I mean, there's an exception to every part of the Constitution in one form or fashion. It just has to do with the needs of society. But here, this is called the public safety exception, or sometimes referred to as the exigent circumstances exception. And it's where you say the police officer has a reasonable argument to say that there was an imminent threat to somebody else in the community, maybe around Boston, or that there were other accomplices at large, or that there was no evidence, there was specific evidence of a broader plot. So, I mean, that's not an unreasonable type of standard. As a matter of fact, that standard lived through the Warren Court, which, as you probably know, was a fairly progressive, liberal kind of court. Mm-hmm. And they said there are naturally times when a police officer has to do certain things without jumping through all the hoops on issues like Miranda. And so I don't really see any problem with it. Frankly, nothing has been expanded by anything that has happened here except except what they may have done is they may have given this this defendant a chance to have a lot of what he said thrown out of court. Now, because it's always a value judgment, Tom. Ultimately, a judge has to hear the facts and they have to say, okay, well, yeah, it's reasonable to not have read him Miranda because it was possible that after hour number four there wasn't a problem, after number five there was a problem. You see, they have to do it by the total circumstances. Here, this is a very difficult problem for this particular defendant. This defendant right now is being handled, obviously, just as a private U.S. citizen rather than any kind of enemy combatant. But the things that he's saying and the things that he's doing are kind of causing should cause concern to his defense team. The whole issue of separating the regular defendant who's simply a citizen, U.S. citizen, he's been charged with something, and the idea of being called an enemy combatant, being able to be handled completely different, is this, and that is whether or not this defendant was acting by way of any kind of direction or being by way of an association or being motivated or engaged. Very, very loose words here, by the way, I want to point out, by Al-Qaeda or by any terrorist group that might be related to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. Now, that, of course, came out of 9/11. And so right now we hear him making, there's things that are happening. The idea of the statement that, the driver wasn't killed because he wasn't an American, that shows intent. In other words, what's driving this defendant? The idea that, on day one he's talking freely about a lot of things. And as he's talking, he's saying things like, my brother was motivated by political ideology, if you drill right down to it. And then the second thing is that we learned how to build this bomb from directions from Al-Qaeda. So these are all things the defense has got to be concerned about, because the issue is here is the difference of a death penalty. I mean, we're not just talking about, did he do it? I think they're going to be able to establish he did it. But the next question is, how do you keep him alive as a defendant in all of this? So there's a lot of moving parts to this. I do like the fact that the administration is presently taking the position that he's not an enemy combatant, and that they don't want to create a hybrid between something that looks like an enemy combatant and, I suppose, a private citizen.
Yeah, I think the Bush administration drilled enough holes in the Constitution.
Oh.
And between you and Bybee, John Yoo and Jay Bybee, it twisted it into a pretzel. And to his credit, I think that President Obama, by refusing to use the phrase war on terror and dialing back. Now, we can criticize his drone policy and other things, but still, I think we have moved in a far more positive direction than we would have if, for example, John McCain was president right now.
Well, he's at least showing some elements of being the constitutional law professor that he was. Some of that is finally surfacing. It surfaces rarely lately, but this seems to be a time that it is surfacing. He realizes that if you take what Bybee and you did in interpreting how far the president can go, it could be argued that the president even has right to come up with some hybrid that all of a sudden a U.S. citizen who simply has broken the law is thrown into some element of being an enemy combatant. And I think this president and the people around him are at least aware of that today. Now, will that change? I don't know. Yeah. But I can tell you the statements by people like Graham and McCain, Gohmert, these boneheads that have no sense of what the intellectual analysis is. Those statements are very reckless and they're dangerous because the truth is the police did a very good job here, Tom. They did a great job. They did it right. They did it the way they were supposed to. Far better than the military has shown they're able to do.
Yeah. You know, Mike, if I may interrupt, my favorite headline after this kid was arrested was "Terrorist Brought Down by Union Thugs." And, of course, it was the Unionized Police Department. Go ahead.
well, that is true. But if you look at what was done from day one, I'm hugely critical sometimes. These guys did a good job.
Yeah, I agree. These union thugs, they did a great job, and God bless them. We need more police unions and stronger ones in this country. Mike Papantonio, you can watch, you can listen to his show, watch his show, learn all about it at ringoffireradio.com. Pap, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. It's 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, that's ringoffireradio.com for Mike Papantonio's website and Bobby Kennedy and Sam Cedar. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. Warren in Kirkland, Washington, listening on 91.3 FM. Hey, Warren, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about Simpson bolts? Really?
Yes. Hey, you know, this Thomas Herndon, the 28-year-old economics grad student from UMass Amherst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he just proved all this austerity math incorrect.
Right.
That was on. You're going to put your palm to your face on this one. He did that on the 18th. And then on the 19th, Bowles and Simpson release a new deficit reduction plan based on the discredited austerity research.
Right, which they'd probably been working on for 6 months. I mean, you know, but still, the irony is not, it's impossible to ignore. Yeah.
And I've seen no retraction either. So.
No, of course not. These guys are not going to give up their $40,000 WAC speaking fees and their little mini industry of being, hey, I'm Simpson, I'm Bowles. It's like the Penn and Teller show, only not funny and not interesting and wrong.
Yeah, it's just ideology. That's all it is. They just want something to prove their ideology. The facts be damned.
Yeah. I'm with you, Warren. And people really need to know this, that Europe and the United States and the Republican Party and even the Democratic Party and even the President of the United States all bought into this theory that there was a reason, that there was some wise reason that this Reinhart-Rogoff paper that showed that when debt-to-GDP ratios exceeded 90%, countries started going into recession, that there was some truth to this. And so people started getting hysterical about, you know, okay, we got to do something. We got to get the budget deficit under control. It's a deficit is a problem, quack, quack, quack. And as you correctly point out, this 28-year-old recent economics grad discovers that these guys did their spreadsheet wrong. I mean, it was just a basic, stupid math error. And not only that, they excluded entire countries and entire times when the United States, like after World War II, when we exceeded 90% of debt to GDP, they just ignored this stuff. And you have to wonder, what the hell is going on? Why? How? How did this happen? I'm personally of the opinion that this was not just a mistake. But, you know, who knows? But whether it was just a mistake or whether it was, hey, let's get out there and force the Democrats to shoot Santa Claus, which has been the effect. You know, now you've got the President of the United States saying, okay, let's dial back Social Security, which is unbelievable for, you know, to get a Democrat to say. It has been completely discredited. It is nonsense. And Warren, you're absolutely right. Thanks for calling it out. Carol in St. Paul, Minnesota, listening on Minnesota's Progressive Voice, AM 950. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Okay, I'm here to back you up. I read it at Crooks and Liars while I was waiting.
Mm-hmm.
I did it. The study was debunked, and listen to this. Reinhardt is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
Bingo! Pete Peterson, of course, is the Wall Street billionaire who has spent about a half a billion, about $500 million of his own money trying over the last decade or so trying to get Social Security privatized. Presumably, he's been saying he's doing it because he cares about America, but I think he's doing it because, you know, it's $2.7 trillion that he wants Wall Street to get their hands on.
Yep, and it's deeper than that. Her husband works for the American Enterprise Institute, which, of course, is funded by Peterson and the Kochs. And Kenneth Rogoff is on the advisory board of the Peterson Institute.
Oh, God. This is amazing.
Do you think it's a mistake?
No, I no longer think it's a mistake. I think it's a scam. The whole thing is a scam. It's a scam from top to bottom. And Reinhard Rogoff may, you know, is part of the scam, but there's this much, much larger scam that has been going on since 1935 about saying, oh, Social Security, it's a Ponzi scam. It's this, that. It's not going to last. It's going to die. You don't worry. It's nonsense. And it's because A, Wall Street wants to get their hands on our Social Security money. And B, because the conservatives genuinely believe that the most stable form of political system is to have a very small middle class, basically a mercantile middle class, the doctor, the lawyer, and the small shop owner. And, you know, like during Dickens, I mean, Scrooge had one employee, he was a small business owner. And so you got a small group of people who are very rich, a very small middle class, and everybody else is Bob Cratchit. Everybody else is the working poor. And this is incredibly stable. Carol, Shano yells in my ear here that you are going to get a copy of Unequal Protection. Do you have a copy of Unequal Protection? Because we can give you a different book.
Let me double check. I've got your books right here. I do not think I have yes, I do.
You have Unequal Protection.
The American Dream.
How about rebooting the American Dream? No, Unequal Protection is how corporations became people and how you can fight back.
Yep, I've got that.
You've got that?
I've got Rebooting the American Dream.
Okay, how about the Tom Hartman Reader?
No, I'd love it.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold, and you're our book recipient for the day. Thank you, Carol. She's on line three. Let Danielle know. And this is, by the way, going to be sent to you courtesy of stamps.com. So a Tom Hartman Reader is actually the most recent of my books to come out. So anyhow, we have just 1 minute. A little less than a minute, and I've got this really juicy call coming up. I just don't want to do it until after the break. So let me just go back to Reinhard Rogoff for just a minute. Reinhard Rogoff connected to the Peterson Institute, Pete Peterson, a Wall Street billionaire who has dedicated his life to privatizing Social Security. These guys on Wall Street, I mean, you know, making $1 billion, you know, in a year, $2 billion, it's not enough for them. They want the whole enchilada. There's $2.7 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund. $2.7 trillion. And they're looking at that going, whoa, think what we could do with that. I mean, we could just churn that. We could skim a little bit off the top. We could buy another private jet. We could buy three new mansions. We could buy another island off the coast of Mallorca or something. I mean, you know, it's just like, wow. Incredible. Carol, thank you for the call. Thanks for the information. 28 minutes past. I'm off to Crooks and Liars to hear. We're 28 minutes past.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
CrooksandLiars.com, a great website, by the way. We will be right back. good, the bad, and the very, very perviciously ugly, the good. The Rolling Jubilee Fund, the New York-based debt-striking group, has raised more than $1 million to help buy up medical debt for over 1,000 residents of the Louisville metropolitan area in Kentucky. Formed in the wake of the 2011 Occupy Wall Street movement, Rolling Jubilee uses personal donations to bail out everyday Americans, not banksters. Despite the 2010 health care law, medical debt remains the leading cause of bankruptcy in the United States. With a little help from Rolling Jubilee, thousands of Louisville residents can now sleep a little easier tonight, knowing they have one less financial stress hanging over their heads. Good work, Rolling Jubilee. By the way, if you want to make a donation to the group's bailout fund, check out rollingjubilee.org. The bad. Kate Obenshane. Watch out, America. The far-left Islamic extremist United Front is joining together to destroy our freedoms. Don't believe me? Well, let Republican strategist Kate Obenshane explain.
The Muslim radicals are targeting the United States because they hate everything we believe in. Freedom, individualism, free markets, the right to be whomever you want to be. There is something about that. I know that this is going to raise some alarm bells, but there's something about that that liberals find appealing. This
Right. Just another day in the wild and crazy world of Fox so-called news. And very, very ugly, the George W. Bush Presidential Library. Today, world dignitaries gathered at the campus of the Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, to celebrate the opening of former George W. Bush, President George W. Bush's museum and library. According to its website, the museum uses four themes: freedom, responsibility, opportunity, and compassion, to help visitors understand the life and career of the 43rd President of the United States. One of the museum's largest exhibits, the Decision Points Hall, provides the public with primary source documents and encourages adults and children alike to try and reenact some major Bush-era policy dilemmas. You know, like whether or not to invade a country based on faulty intelligence. While the library's Iraq section admits that Saddam Hussein didn't have any WMDs, you can be sure there is no special exhibit devoted to the millions dead in Baghdad and beyond, where the thousands of American soldiers maimed for life fighting Bush's wasteful war. If W could have shown compassion for their lives, if only. Make no mistake about it. Pretensions to objectivity and principal themes aside, the George W. Bush Library is just a glorified PR campaign for a war criminal, and that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. I mean, just mind-bogglingly ugly. Now, Aaron in Los Angeles, watching us on DirecTV, on Free Speech TV, your problem with progressives is that they perpetuate all these myths? Is that seriously what you told Danielle?
Yeah, that's what I told her.
Okay, what myths?
Okay, first of all, you perpetuate the myth of the omnipotent president. It's pretty much proven with John Kennedy and what happened to him. What would happen to a president if he nationalized the banks or tried to pull out of a war when the middle military-industrial complex didn't want him to?
So, wait a second. You're suggesting that the military-industrial complex killed John Kennedy?
I said what I said. I don't have to be explicit for it. I mean,
well, I'm personally of the opinion that the mafia killed John Kennedy because he had commenced over 700 prosecutions of them. But
yeah, they used the Chicago outfit.
I've never said that the president is omnipotent or that he's incapable of being killed.
No.
In fact, I wrote two books on the Kennedy assassination.
Okay, what I'm saying is, like, when Mike Pepitone is like, oh, well, he's listening to Eric Holder and these guys. No, he's listening to trying to stay alive. The reason LBJ had so much power is because he had thousands and thousands of people mobilized in the streets from the Weather Underground, the Martin Luther King, on every faction where they knew they had to do something. Now he had the opportunity to go to the power brokers and say, look, we have to do something.
I don't disagree with the sentiment of that point. I certainly wouldn't have said it that way, and there are some pieces of that that I might want to deconstruct. But The fact of the matter is that Lyndon Johnson did have millions of people in the street protesting the war in Vietnam, and right. that's why in 1968 he successfully negotiated an end to the war in Vietnam with the between the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese, a successful negotiation that the Nixon campaign, Bill Casey specifically, that the or not Bill Casey, that the Nixon campaign in 1968 blew up, stopped. They stopped the Paris peace talks so that Richard Nixon could beat Hubert Humphrey in the election of 68. But again, I don't see what this has to do with liberal myths.
No, the other myth is the American exceptionalism. And I've heard, it wasn't exactly you, sir, but it was a guy that was filling in for you a couple of days ago. And, you know, they talk about how exceptional America is. We're the greatest country in the world and all that. That all depends on what your definition of great is, you know.
Well, I don't disagree with that point, Aaron. We're 29 in healthcare. We're certainly not the greatest country in the world in terms of providing healthcare to our people.
I think me and you agree on a lot, but you had another guy that was, you know.
Yeah, I know, Dr. Mike fills in. I didn't hear him say it, so I can't speak to it. And it would be inappropriate to do so, and I'm sure that there was more context around it than just that. But, you know, if you want to complain about something I'm saying, bring it to me. If you want to complain about something, you know, Dr. Mike said, I think he's going to be on tomorrow filling in for him because I got to be on an airplane on my way to Portland. So,
I wasn't really complaining about what you
But there is something to be said for American exceptionalism. And frankly, in France, there's something to be said for French exceptionalism. In Sweden, there's something to be said for Swedish exceptionalism. I have lived in several countries. I've lived in two countries for, you know, more than a year. I've worked in at least three or four countries to the point where I've spent, you know, months in those countries or, you know, protracted weeks, enough to get a sense of what's going on. And I can tell you, every citizen of every country, well, not every country. Actually, there's some that are pretty, you know, pretty pathetic. But there, you know, most of the developed countries of the world, the people who live there are like, hey, you know, we're the coolest place. And America is no different than that. But the fact of the matter is that we really were one of the original experiments back in 1773, 1776, and 1787, you know, when we ratified proposed the Constitution, 1789, when we ratified it. And we have led the world in a lot of very positive ways. Now, we've screwed up a whole lot of things, too. I can recite the list just as fast as Howard Zinn can, but we've done a lot of good things. And I think that, you know, we need to give ourselves credit at the same time that we hold ourselves accountable.
I believe that. Okay, one other thing is the reason Obama and the administration have to do a lot of things they do, like going against Social Security, because every network is putting experts on TV and on the radio saying that the deficit is a problem and Social Security and Medicare are the biggest drivers.
Yeah.
So if he goes against that, then they'll say, see, he's out of touch with reality.
Yeah, see, I think, you know, you might be right, Aaron. I don't know. I this is one where I cannot figure out what's going on at the White House. Why would this be the first Democratic president since FDR, you know, invented Social Security to say we're going to take a bite out of Social Security? I don't get it. I mean, already, you know, crazy Michelle Bachmann, for goodness sake, has come out and said that she opposes the president's plan to have the chain CPI, which will reduce Social Security payments. I mean, the Republicans are going to run on this. This is probably the biggest blunder that this White House has made since they began. But again, I haven't heard any progressive myths from you that I'm perpetuating.
I believe you just perpetuated one because Clinton did something against Social Security too.
What was that?
The Clinton administration.
Well, they changed the way the cost of living adjustment was adjusted. Not only did the Clinton administration, the both Bush administration, I'm not sure the second Bush administration did, the first Bush administration did, the Reagan administration did big time. And I think virtually all of those are wrong. It used, you know, when Social Security was first started, not first started, but by the 50s, you know, Republican President Dwight Eisenhower was solidly behind Social Security, you could live on Social Security. You couldn't live well, but you could live on Social Security. It's very, very hard to live on Social Security now.
But don't forget, I think the administration is also gambling on the fact that these idiots aren't going to go for anything anyway, so it's just he's not going to have to do anything in Social Security.
Yeah, it may well be, but Aaron, I'm still not hearing myths, so I'm going to move along. I know that Armin will have something for me here. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
Hey, Brother Tom, I got something really good for you. Have you read the piece titled, If You Want to Go to Heaven, You Had Better Get Busy Overthrowing Syria?
No.
By Paul Craig Roberts?
No, I have not.
Now our great country, that honest government we have, is through back channels financing Al-Qaeda sympathizers, and they are...
Well, we've been doing that for a long, long time. You know, we help create Al-Qaeda to fight the Soviets.
I know, CIA.
You know, to fight the Soviets
anyway,
in Afghanistan.
We're doing that now. That's the rebels that Wolf U-Bolt, Mike Malloy used to call Blitzer. He calls him the U-Bolt commander, Wolf Blitzer.
Yeah.
He's sitting there saying the rebels. It's amazing how they control the narrative.
Well, you know, I'll have to look for that. Paul Craig Roberts, you know, keep in mind, Armin, was an official in the Treasury Department, as I recall, in the Reagan administration. So you might want to take a certain grain of salt with some of the things he says. We've had him on the program a few times, and he and I have mixed it up. But thanks for the heads up, Armin. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Shocked, absolutely shocked. Pete Peterson's fingerprints all over that bogus economic study. That's the headlines of Crooks and Liars. I'm shocked. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Ocean Robin's going to be with us in just a second, but it's Thursday. Let's get geeky on a very, very smart on the very smart animal kingdom. We start off tonight with everyone's favorite insect, the ant. Researchers at the University in Switzerland individually barcode tagged every worker ant within an entire colony and tracked them with a computer. Figure out what's going on. Over 41 days, what they found, studying six different colonies, more than 100 carpenter ants each, that the ants were constantly filmed by cameras. 2.4 billion readings, 9.4 million interactions. After 41 days of studies, this is what they found. It turns out that of the ants studied, nearly 40% were nurse ants who cared for the queen. 30% were foragers who got brought in the food, and the remaining 30% were janitors. They cleaned. In other words, they had jobs, just like humans, you know. And plus, they moved between jobs as they got older, which is, you know, another fascinating thing. But ants aren't the only surprisingly smart species in the animal kingdom. According to new research, the roving coral grouper, a species of predator fish, uses sign language to help other predator fish species detect hiding prey. This is the first time that a fish has been known to make specific signs alerting other fish. So it's pretty amazing, that, you know, all this stuff coming out. You know, the wisdom of nature, the just genuine wisdom of nature. Speaking of wisdom, Ocean Robbins is with us. He's the CEO of the Food Revolution Network and the co-author with his dad, John Robbins, of Voices of the Food Revolution, the website foodrevolution.org. And Ocean, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So tell us, what is Food Revolution?
Well, I think that we live in a context right now where what's normal is food that's often genetically engineered, it's mass-produced, it's devoid of fiber and minerals, it's been chemically processed and pesticide-contaminated, it's been grown in unsustainable ways, animals are being treated inhumanely, and it's pseudo-food. You know, it's food-like substances, and we're all paying the price for it. We're paying a terrible price for it. In the United States today, we have the world's highest in history rates of obesity and diabetes. We have levels of chronic illness that are the highest on the planet. More and more people are sick. More and more kids are sick. And we're paying the price that economically, 19% of U.S. GDP is going to healthcare costs right now.
Right.
In fact, it shouldn't even be called healthcare. It should be called disease care because we're not focusing on the foundations of health, which is a good diet. We're focusing on ameliorating the symptoms of a bad diet. And certain companies are making a whole lot of money selling this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But we're paying the price, and we're calling for a food revolution because I think it's time for a radical change.
Okay, so how does this food revolution that you and your dad are we're talking with Ocean Robbins, the CEO of the Food Revolution Network, excuse me, co-author with his dad of Voices of the Food Revolution, foodrevolution.org. Tell us about foodrevolution.org, Ocean.
Well, we're launching a Food Revolution Summit the day after tomorrow. We're interviewing 24 of the world's top leaders in movements for healthy, sustainable, humane, and conscious food, including yourself. We're so thrilled to have you on board, Tom. And these
I'm
are people
honored
who are
to be
all
there.
Up to something, you know, making a difference in the world in really big ways. And, you know, over half of them are New York Times bestselling authors. And we're bringing out their voices. We decided to say, you know, what do the experts know about what's really going on with food? If we get away from all the spin, all the hype, everybody trying to make a buck selling a product, what's really going on with our food systems? And how can we distill the wisdom of people who are dedicating their lives to bringing consciousness to this issue, you know, how can we bring that wisdom out to the world?
So you're basically running a webcast, a program?
Yeah, there's going to be 3 interviews every day.
Okay.
For the course of 8 days with these incredible leaders. My dad's doing the interviewing. My dad, John Robbins, is the best-selling author of Diet for New America and many other books.
Mm-hmm.
And we're producing the summit together so people can sign up for free at foodrevolution.org
right.
and check it out, learn about these incredible speakers, and get access to this powerful information that, you know, it can change your life. But we're not just looking at food personally. We're also looking at how we make healthy food more affordable and more accessible, and how we change government policy so that we really, you know, we make it so that, that kids can access healthy food without having to be lucky enough to live with rich parents that are super educated. We want to make this more accessible.
Where would you begin? What in your mind, what is the most important first step for people who want to be part of a revolution in food in America?
Well, on a personal level, the beautiful thing is that you can fight the food revolution without swords or bombs. You just need a knife and a fork.
Just become a vegan, basically.
The only collateral damage is better health and more energy and a brighter future for future generations. So you start by looking at your own food choices and how you can participate in more organic, natural, local, sustainable, humanely raised foods, more mm-hmm. plants and, you know, plant-based foods, more real food instead of junk food. And, you know, from there, you can keep going. You know, food is so social. You tell your friends, you tell your community. What you do sends out ripples, and it has an impact on what's cool in the world around you. And then you can lobby governments. You know, I'm sick and tired of having our government spending tens of billions of dollars subsidizing junk food.
Right.
You know, a lot of the government subsidy in the farm bill is going to things like factory farms and high fructose corn syrup and genetically engineered soybeans. And I'd rather see it going to broccoli and healthy stuff, you know, that we know is going to be good for people.
Mm, absolutely. So we're speaking with Ocean Robbins, the CEO of the Food Revolution Network, the co-author with his dad, John Robbins, of Voices of the Food Revolution. Foodrevolution.org is the website. Coming up, 3 interviews a day. I'll be one of them every day for how long?
8 days.
For 8 days.
April 27th till May 4th.
Okay, April 27th through May 4th. You can sign up over at foodrevolution.org. And I think that this is the core stuff, Ocean. This is, you know, the old cliche, you know, you're nothing if you don't have your health. And at the foundation of this is the fuel, is the food.
Well, I think you're right. And the irony is that we have a food industry that pays no attention to health for the most part. And we have a medical industry that, for the most part, pays no attention to food.
Right.
And doctors in all their years of medical school get an average of about 24 hours of training in nutrition.
Wow. And even that is training that was provided to them courtesy of the food industry. Ocean Robbins, the website is foodrevolution.org. Thanks, Ocean, for dropping by.
Thanks so much.
Good talking with you. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman program, more of the latest news and information from Wall Street to Main Street, everywhere in between, plus Anything Goes Friday. What do you want to talk about? Best of the rest of your calls. Dr. Michael B. here. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. Tag your it. Like, occupy something like pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org or free-don.com. Do it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.